The following presentation was recorded at the 2013 Conservative Anabaptist School Board Institute. More information at thedocforlearning.org.
Thank you, brother, for those thoughts. How many of you have ever been in a congregation where someone prayed or said, expressed thanksgiving that we can meet here today unmolested and unharmed? Who ever heard such an expression? That's in our memory, isn't it? That's in our memory. We heard this morning that the people who do not suffer persecution, it's easy to become apathetic. And I might mention this evening, actually, Brother Alan Byler would have been moderating this evening. He actually is, picking up some of Ken Miller's family at an airport somewhere and taking them someplace. That's why he's not here. Many of you know about Ken Miller's situation. That's just a little bit of a taste, maybe, of what we might have coming our way. But this evening we have a committee always wonders about a good topic for an evening like this after a day in which the fire hydrant has been opened. It's time to turn the sprinkler on for a while instead. And so we thought this evening an appropriate topic would be something that's both informative but also, I think, very instructive for us. And that is, there is another group of people who also know what it's like to be molested and harmed. These are the people that we knew as a young man. I show my age here. We know that under communist Russia, there were many people in the underground church, whatever they called themselves, Baptists, Pentecostals, whatever, in Eastern Europe and Russia, Ukraine, who were oppressed in many ways. But since the Iron Curtain fell, why, they could leave. And so they have left by the thousands and come to this country. And I remember first hearing about this some years back. The way I heard about it was that some of them were starting their own schools and asking for help from people from Christian Light. And so Brother Lyndon Hartman is going to share some stories with us this evening. Partly this will be an education for us. Who are these people? What has been some of their journey? And what has been their experience in coming to this land of freedom? And what are they experiencing today? And how are they navigating this, living in this society? And as we listen, let's learn and let's have our inner ears open for a lesson for us in this. Our people have been here for a couple centuries, and they've just been here for a couple decades. But I think there's something for us to ponder as we hear Brother Lyndon.
I want to greet each one in the precious name of Jesus this evening, who hath made of one blood all nations. I'm ashamed of myself as I look back at my past and in my thinking about other people that weren't Anabaptists. Now, I was just tickled when anybody came into the Anabaptist church and joined. Why, that was wonderful. And I wanted to make them feel at home and all. But, you know, there's other groups out there, and, you know, can they really be saved if they're not an Anabaptist? And I'm glad I'm not the judge. I'm not the judge of that. But in my experience, I have had to come face to face with that time and time again and say, these people are serving God also. These are some other sheep of God's fold. They are on a learning curve as well as I. I don't have an inside track to God's grace or mercy outside of the blood of Jesus Christ. And they have appropriated that for their life also. So I try not to question quite the way I did in the past. I'm still growing in that. I need to tell you a little bit about myself so that you'll understand the context for the tonight. I work for Christian Light Education part of the time. I have a cabinet shop at home. And one of the things I am asked to do, well, one of the things is teacher training. Elmer Glick and I do teacher trainings together at the home office. I'm from Western Ohio, kind of out on the frontier, according to you people in Pennsylvania. And I come into Virginia, help with teacher training, and also go up into Ontario every summer with Pete Peters, another teacher trainer from CLE. He's from Manitoba. We meet there and work with Russian Mennonites there in southern Ontario. Then I may go out and do teacher trainings other places around the United States. So that's part of my job working for CLE. Another job that I have, which consumes more of my time probably, is being what's called a school rep. And CLE has asked several men to go out and we visit schools. This is, if you want us to come visit your school, we'll be glad to do that. There isn't a charge or anything like that. Elmer Glick is in charge of that. He's my boss. In that respect, Elmer Glick and I, and Peter Witt. Peter's here, I think, or was earlier today. Then there's Ken Kaufman from Arkansas, and Pete Peters from Manitoba. I cover an area of Ohio, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Kentucky, with different ones of us getting out to like Missouri and Oklahoma. Last year I went out there. So that's part of my job for CLE. I go and visit these schools. It is not me coming in and evaluating the school. I am there totally as a help to the school. If the teachers have questions, if they have problems, they're to ask them while I'm there. They're free to call, things like that. So that's some of the work that I do. The fact that you go into these many different schools, you go to Beachy schools, you go to Mennonite schools, you go to, I've been in Amish schools, I've been in a lot of different schools. And they're all Anabaptists, so there's a certain flavor there that stays the same. But then I start getting into these other schools, and like Russian Mennonite there in southern Ontario gives me a taste of that. We also get into that some, and we'll be doing one in Texas this year. That's Russian Mennonite, and also 2 years ago in Kansas, we went and did one. That starts giving me a different flavor, different culture, different people. And they do things differently than we do. And all of a sudden, I realize that the way that I've done it in Elida, Ohio, the way I've taught school there, the way our school has done things, is not necessarily the best way to do it. It may be for our culture, but maybe another culture has a different and a better way to do something in their area. And we need to be able to accept that and realize that. My horizons have widened terrifically. Now, the danger there is I do not want to adopt anything into my life that is harmful or evil or that would pull me down. So I try to be careful in that also. For a beginning scripture, I want to look at a verse in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2. As we think about our schools, the verse there, Paul's writing to Timothy, and he says, "The things that thou hast heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit thou to faithful men, who shall be able to teach others also." And I'm always impressed with that verse, of the idea that Timothy was to tell what he had learned from Paul to other people, so that they can teach. Are you satisfied in your schools that your students just get an education? I'd like our schools to provide a lot more teachers so that they have been taught well enough so that when they come out of the school system, they can teach. Now, not everybody's cut out to be a teacher. I know that. But I think there's some people that need some encouragement along that line that with a little bit of encouragement, they'd be good teachers. Okay, but we want to talk about Russians tonight and tell stories. I like to tell stories, and Harold Dean knows that. Harold Dean and I went down into Mexico last winter and had a wonderful time there with the Russian Mennonites. One thing I want to make clear from the beginning is that the people that I'm talking about tonight are not Mennonite. They are not Russian Mennonite. They are Russian Pentecostal. That is what the ones that I have had contact with. There are also Russian Baptists. Maybe, is there any hands of people that have worked with either of those groups? Russian, okay, got several that have worked with those. So hopefully I don't give misinformation out. You can correct me if that's the case. About 16 years ago, a group of, we just call them Slavic groups here in the eastern United States, a Slavic group in New York began a school on their own. Fellowship Church helped them, provided some teachers, I believe, and worked alongside them for quite a few years and tried to wean them off of their help. They tried it a couple years then on their own, and in 2009, they came to CLE and asked for training for their teachers. A desperate need that this group has is teachers. And they would love to pull Mennonite young people in as teachers. They say, you guys know how to teach. You've done this for years and years. This is all new to us. We just came over to the U.S. Since about 1990. A lot of the people have not been here long. And the idea of running their own school is a new thought to them. Now, we're going to talk about another group later on, and that's a different story. But this group, it was new concepts, new ideas, and they were just pulling out of a pool of their local people, some of them having been educated in the public school system here in the U.S., but they wanted to start their own school. Well, they had their own school by this time, but they needed help with teachers. How big a group do you think that is? How many of you know of a Mennonite church that has 1,000 members? That church in Utica, New York has 1,000 members and 600 children. I'm not sure if the 600 children is all children or if that's just school-age children. The sad part to me is that in the school that they started, they only have, and this seems to all be true somewhat in different areas, only 10% of the children come. Only 60 children come to that school. At one time, there was less even than that. During some hard years, they have been doing much better recently. Ken Kaufman became very involved with that, and he still is. He sent me an email asking for, I was hoping he'd be here tonight and just have him speak for 10 minutes of the time here on that. He has spent, and since 2009, he's probably spent about 21 days in that community working with them, doing teacher trainings. They've actually voted him on the school board. He attends school board meetings sometimes over the phone. He's done a lot of work with those people, and he's had to be very blunt with them. How would you like to try to run a school when the ministry weren't really behind it? How would you like to run a school where all of the older people in your church were against it? It's the young people that want to have their own Christian school. The older people say, and I don't know if this is a per word quote, but basically, we went through school in communist Russia, and we came to the Christian United States where the public schools are Christian. Why do we need our own schools? That's their mentality. That's the older people's mentality in some of those settings. Not all of them, but many of the older people would look at it that way. And the younger people, and these are people that have small children that are just about school age. These younger people have, many of them have went at least through high school here in the U.S. They know what the public school system is like. They're not illusioned at all. And they say, we've got to do something or we're going to lose. And they realize that they are losing their youth. Now they have 1,000 members. They have 600 children. Amazing amount of people. And to me, I just thought, like, oh my. You know, I know there's lots of Mennonites in Lancaster and Holmes County and places like that, but large concentrations of people that believe quite quite similar to the way we do. There's some differences. But these people are facing much opposition from within their group as they struggle to keep these schools going. I'm talking about the school there in Utica, New York. Okay, not this past summer, but the summer before, we got a call from Lexington, Kentucky. There is a group there, basically the same people. And there was some people from Utica, New York that had moved there and said, we want to have our own school here. This group is 600 members, and they have about 600 children also. Large congregation, large families. Ken Kaufman was asked to come there, and Ken called me up and he says, Lyndon, it's really your territory. He says, I want you to come too, because more than likely you're going to get it turned over to you. Ken lives about 10 hours away from this place in Kentucky. It's at Lexington, which is straight south of where I live. I have about 3.5 to 4 hours. I said, okay. And we went, and it's blessed to meet with people. And even though they're broken English and their differences in culture and stuff, you have to warm up to these people and realize that God is working also in their lives, but the devil is busy there as well. Now, in that congregation, the minister is, and I don't know if there's multiple ministers, I'll just say the pastoral team there, is behind the project. But they adopt a wait-and-see mentality. They value education, and they value it highly, and they're afraid that their own school, if they start their own Christian school, it will not be able to come up to their standard of value of education. They called us in, I wish I could remember this a little better, but I think they called us in April of 2011, and Ken and I went and talked to them. They said, is there a possibility we could start a school by this fall? Ken and I looked at each other and we shook our heads. How in the world can a congregation just start from nothing? And they had nothing, no school board, nothing. You know, we are so blessed. We have operated so long on our past. I don't ever remember not having a school in our congregation in Elida High. Our school started in 46, I think. Long time before I was born. And there's always been somebody there that passed on the torch to somebody else. And here you have a group of people that are trying to start from scratch, and they're going to try to do it in a couple months. They have no teachers. They don't even know if they've got students that'll come. They know there's some interest. They know there's a few people. And Ken, I was able to be there on a Saturday with them. Ken stayed through Sunday with them and spoke with them some on school issues Saturday night and Sunday also. He had a very good time there. And then it's been kind of my responsibility since then. It's been a real learning curve for me as I visit them. I visited that school 3 times last school year. And that's usually, I don't get to school more than once a year, and sometimes it's every other year. But I knew they needed help. And I went there that first time, and that place was chaos. They had the school up and running. They had around 23 students. Some of the classrooms were fairly orderly. Some of them were not. They were struggling with the curriculum. The children had all been taken out of public school and placed in this setting. And they were used to making B's without trying. And suddenly, they were working with Anabaptist material that expects you to sit up and fly straight. And they were making C's and D's. And they had to work. And they were disgusted. The children were. And I thought, how is this ever going to work? And I encouraged the teachers. Last year, whenever I called up and said I was coming, they immediately reduced the school to a half a day, and the teachers and I sat around for most of the afternoon just going over problems they were facing, and I tried to encourage as much as possible. The second time I went, there was a big difference. And some of the teachers finally said, we've got to quit focusing so much on academics, and we're just going to focus on order. And there's some lessons we could learn from sitting in some of their classrooms. I was impressed as I sat in a classroom, and every time that a child wanted to participate in the discussion, he had to raise his hand, then stand up by his desk and state it in as plain English as he was capable of, and then could sit down. If he forgot to stand up, he was reprimanded by the teacher, and that teacher put a lot of effort into respect for authority. She has no problem with her class anymore. She's teaching again this year, doing a very fine job. I decided and I would go visit that school again this year. I went on Tuesday, and they said, Lyndon, how are we doing? I said, well, it's a lot better than that first time when I came. They said, oh, you say that every time you come. There's just a drastic difference as those people are working with that situation. That first year, they had kindergarten through fifth grade. This year, they have kindergarten through seventh grade. First year, they had 23 students and ended up with 21. This year, they started out, I think, with 29, and right now they've got 23. Again, there's 600 children in that congregation. And the parents, the main body of parents, adopt a wait and see. We want to wait and see what this school is really going to do. Some of them are sure that it's too hard. Well, my child can make B's in the public school. You know, you look at those mentalities, and I'm afraid that I see that sometimes in our Anabaptist circles. The curriculum is too hard, or, you know, there's too much homework. There's, you know, it certainly couldn't be my child's fault or my fault. It must be the school, so I'm just going to go with the public school system. Besides, it's cheaper. I'll get along better there. They're not willing to pay the price there. As I worked with those people, I found out there are two churches in Cleveland, Ohio. Each of them have about 400 members with 400 children. There's also a church in Columbus of about the same size, I think, or similar. They said there's other churches up at Cleveland. There's about five or six of their churches at Cleveland. The others are smaller. I was just amazed that these large groups of these Russian immigrants, Slavic people, they speak Ukraine. They're desperately trying to hang on to their Ukrainian culture. They speak Ukrainian in the home. But that creates a problem. I was talking with the teachers there on Tuesday, and one of the teachers said, I'm having so much trouble. And let's see, she was working with sixth and seventh graders. She said, I'm having so much trouble with comprehension. I said, no offense, but what is spoken in the home? Well, she said, a lot of us speak Ukrainian. But she said, most of the children by sixth and seventh grade know English. I said, yeah, but what about their reading material? You know, do the parents know English well enough? Well, probably not. It's easier for them to speak Ukraine. So when she is doing a reading lesson, and she gave me an example, she said, the word ownership. Nobody in the class knew what the word ownership meant. She said, I had to translate it into Ukrainian, tell them what that, you know, in her mind, and then come back with that. And then, oh, yeah, okay, that made sense to them. Words that we are so used to using because of our English culture are new to them, and they have all sorts of problems because of it. What else do I want to tell you about there? When those people came over to the U.S., they looked somewhat similar to us in conservatism. They are losing that. especially modesty in the sister's dress. The culture in our Western civilization is so free and so open, and you can just do whatever you want, I don't understand the culture over in the Russia that they came from. But evidently there was so much necessity of holding that line over there that it was much easier to hold that line. Maybe there wasn't the availability of material things there either. But amongst all these groups, I see that happening where Western culture, the mindset of the Western world, is creeping into their midst. And that is a challenge. And see, they would love to have us Mennonites send our young people to teach for them. They asked me that again on Tuesday. When are you going to send us some teachers? We just need teachers desperately, they said. Somebody that has experience teaching and knows how to teach. But, and there's some people that have worked with that situation in a controlled environment, and that's fine. But for me just to send even my 25-year-old son into that culture, I'm scared of that. I'm afraid of that. And yet they work, they struggle, and they are maintaining a school, and I have good hopes that they will continue with that outreach. If you think about them, pray for those groups. They desperately want to maintain their identity, their culture, and they are sincere in their desire to live for Christ. And I want the best for them. I know that they realize that to maintain what they have, to hang on to it, they need a Christian school. As I look at that fervor and that desire within those people, I say, we need to learn some lessons there. Do we really have that desire within us? That it's that important that we maintain a godly Christian school in our community? Or is it just ho-hum? Maybe, whatever. If you want to turn to Luke chapter 21, I want to read a couple verses there. We're going to switch stories now to another group. Today we've heard about how that if we want to pay our teachers better, we can. If we want to have better curriculum, better school, better whatever, we can do it. If we just put our mind to it and we apply ourselves and we use our funds in the correct way. There's money. We say there's money for our businesses. Why isn't there money for our schools? We've heard about that several times today. But I'd like you to take you to another level of that commitment and say, what about when you're at the end of the road? What are you willing to sacrifice? That's after you've taken from your abundance. Let's read Luke 21, verse 1. And he looked up and saw the rich men casting their gifts into the treasury, and he saw also a certain poor widow casting in thither two mites. And he said, of a truth, I say unto you that this poor widow hath cast in more than they all. For all these have of their abundance cast in unto the offerings of God, but she of her penury hath cast in all the living that she had. How much would you sacrifice to keep your Christian school? If the authorities came to your community and said, you have to send your children to the public school, what would you do? What would you do? I don't want to scare you tonight. I don't know that that's around the bend for us. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. But I want to talk to you about some people who faced that. Back in May of 2012, towards the end of the month, and then the first couple days of June, Pete Peters and I went to a place in BC. It's called Fort St. John. We were actually about 70 miles, I think. Everything's kilometers up there. I think we're about 70 miles farther northwest from there to have a teacher training. And it was at a colony, kind of like a Hutterite colony, but it was Russian Pentecostals again. These were the people that I remember. I mean, as I listened to their stories, I realized these are the people that I was praying for as a little boy. When in my prayer I'd say, remember the Christians behind the Iron Curtain. These were the ones, more so than the ones that I'm acquainted with here in the eastern United States. And we spent time there. They live in colony. They live together as a group. It is not a closed colony. There is no stigma attached to leaving the colony. You can come or go as you please, as long as you live by the rules and standards that are there. You are part of the colony. Even people who leave the colony can be part of it, but they'll leave for different reasons. Because of the place that they live, which is they're probably 70 miles from the closest real good hospital, at least 45 miles. Some of the older people have decided to move into town, and they may still come out on Sunday and things like that. So it is not a closed colony, but it is built on a colony. They share all things in common. They work, everything goes into one common kitty. They live together. Those of you that enjoy the dynamics of how something like that works, they have one central heating system for the whole village. One boiler. Great big monstrous thing. And it heats all the houses, and every place has a greenhouse because they're far enough north that they don't have, or they have not enough sunlight during the summer to raise good crops. So when I was there at the end of May, they were ready to harvest tomatoes in their greenhouses. Every family, that was their garden, but that's heated by that central boiler. But anyway, a very interesting group. These people, the women wear the covering at all times. It's a scarf tied around the back of the head. They are much more modest than the others that I was talking about, but they would also be Pentecostals. These people would have been of German descent, and I think, if I have my history correct, that it would have been sometime shortly after the First World War that most of them moved to Russia, of this group. Now, there was other groups that moved earlier. But of these people, they moved to Russia back shortly after World War I. And they, because of the fear in Germany that there would be another war, and that this time they would not, I think the first time around they escaped the military to a certain degree, but they knew that that would probably not continue. So they were searching for religious freedom, and they moved to Russia. That seems strange to us today, but that's what they did. And they moved to Russia, and they enjoyed religious freedom for quite some time until around World War II. And then the communist government clamped down on them. It was probably shortly before that, and things began to get very tough for them. You read stories about persecution behind the Iron Curtain, and I don't have a lot of real bad stuff to tell you. I've got one gory story, but this group said in our group we don't consider that we had any martyrs. They said except for one old man. He went to the hospital, and one of our friends, a worldly friend that worked at the hospital, said he was poisoned there. Other than that, they said none of us suffered as a martyr. Some of them probably would have suffered some beatings. Many of the men spent time in Siberia, not all of them. There was a man that picked us up at the airport, Pete Peters and I. His name was Rudy. He would have been there. And then his brother-in-law, Fred. These two men sat and told us stories for hours. And very, very interesting. Fred was missing his one hand up to his wrist, up past his wrist a bit. It was something he lost in a sawmill accident when he was 18. He would have lived in Russia at that time. The authorities tried to send him to Siberia for that accident. They said, you cut your hand off so you wouldn't have to be in the military. That's how their logical, or not logical, reasoning works over there in the KGB. Fred said, I would never cut off my hand to just stay out of the military. Now, he doesn't believe in necessarily being in the military, but he said, I wouldn't do that. And he felt like he escaped by the skin of his teeth that he didn't end up in Siberia for that accident. That's some of the things that those people faced. And as time went on, things began to get more and more desperate. There was a lot of pressure put on them to send their children to the public school. And I think that the way that the KGB thought was that we were going to leave this older generation alone. Let's just get their children. If we can get their children into our school, this will die out. We don't have to worry about it. These people were willing to sacrifice anything it took to keep their children out of the public school. That was one of the main things. That and not participating in the military, at least in a combatant way. Some of the people over there, the Pentecostals, would participate in a non-combatant way. Now, the people that we were with in BC, I felt that they were coming to the realization and knowledge that they should not participate in the military in any way. Okay, so you have those two problems that they were facing. They wouldn't be in the military, and they would not send their children to a public school. Now, they're in a closed place. They can't just run across the border to Canada or something like that. I mean, you know, if that happened here, where would we go? What would you do? And some of those people moved around a lot trying to escape authorities getting after them. And because of that, there were people there on that colony that knew as many as five languages because they've been to so many different little places, and they were probably all variations of Russian or Ukrainian, somewhat similar in the way that they are. But those people clung to the idea that we will not allow our children to be taught by the public school system. And the KGB came to them finally. Many of the men were called in and worked over. I don't know if there was much torture. It doesn't seem like they went through a lot of physical, but it was a lot of mental abuse from the authorities. And finally, one day, the KGB said to whoever was in charge, they said, we will break you. We will break you. You will come to us and beg for a crust of bread. We are going to make sure that you all the men lose their jobs. And they didn't know what to do. At this point, they lived in that community in Russia much the way that you and I live here in the U.S. Of course, there was a lot more persecution there, but I'm talking about as in their community. They each had their individual dwellings and their individual households. First thing the KGB did was take 10 of the men and ship them off to Siberia under trumped-up charges for 15 to 20 years. Fred told me that immediately there was 10 widows, basically, with large families in their midst. He said, we had to go to colony, if you understand what I'm saying there, to go to colony to be in a more of a colony setting where they had all things in common. He said, we had to go to that. We had to share our funds. And he said, we knew, and we didn't know when it would ever end. We knew that we were going to stick it out. He said, you know, our children were not going to go to that public school. And he said, we never starved, but we went hungry. He said, all the men lost their jobs. They scavenged in the forest for things like ginseng, roots that they could sell. And they had worldly neighbors that were sympathetic to them that would take and sell them on the black market. And as you hear the stories, this is something that I found interesting and that my brain had to shift gears a little bit on, is that these people are not they don't have the same view of government that we do. And I came to the realization that they grew up in a place where the government was utterly corrupt from beginning to end, and they have no concept of respect for government. Anyway, so they did what they had to survive. Okay, they have very little money, very little food. Now, what would your focus be at that point? Now, your focus is that you're going to keep your children out of public school. But wouldn't your focus just be on me and trying to hang on to this little tight community that I have, and we're going to survive somehow, and how are we going to do this, and how are we going to maintain this? But those people thought outside of themselves. They knew that the Bible says you are to visit those in prison. Well, they kept remembering those 10 men, and they were probably, many of them probably were relatives, but they believed that what the Bible said. Siberia was a long ways from where they lived. I don't know how far. The KGB was intent on keeping them from visiting those men. So the KGB was carefully checking all the railways within a certain mile radius of that community. But the men would go to overpasses or bridges over top of the railroad that where the freight cars went, drop down on a load of coal, ride for hours till they were outside of that cordoned off place where they knew they'd be safe. Then they would jump off, get on a passenger train. I don't know how they found the money to do it. Go all the way to Siberia and visit their brother in prison. And they come back in the same way. We don't really know what sacrifice is. When I think of those men and what they were willing to do. They told stories of other people that they knew that had it a lot worse than they did. They could always look around and find somebody that had a lot worse. They told about 10 men that were deported to Siberia. They were on a train under prison guard. They were on that train and they were on their way to Siberia. Part of the way there, the train stopped at a place. I think there was other people maybe on the train too. I don't know if it was just a prison train or not. But those 10 men were commanded to get off and get shovels, and it was frozen dirt, and they were to dig their graves. And they dug, and they dug, and they dug. And they were pretty well done, because the guard said, we're just going to shoot you and leave you here. At that point, and what would go through your mind as you did something like that? That's pressure. That's stress. We talk about the stress and pressure of teaching and working with parents and children that don't behave and all, and I think I'll take that. But these men were digging their graves. And the guard stopped them finally and said, how many will recant their faith in Jesus Christ? And 5 of those men recanted right there. Then they spoke to those men and they said, we have guns here. You will shoot the other 5. Now they're kind of in a corner. But they did it. They stood the other men that did not recant in front of the holes and handed guns to the other men and told them to shoot, and they shot. But there was blanks in the gun. Then they told the men who had recanted, they said, we don't want you in the military if this is the way you treat your brethren. And they did kill them and put them in the graves. That actually happened. They took the other 5 men that remained firm and true to their beliefs, and they went on to Siberia and were imprisoned there for some time. Most of these people that were in Siberia, and I think it included those 5 also, they were not of the group that I'm associated with. Those men knew them, but I didn't meet any of those personally. But those people, they were willing to give up so much And a lot of it was over the privilege of teaching their own children and desiring to have their own education and knowing that if they allow the government to take over and teach my children, that it's not going to work, that I'm going to lose my family. And to that, to them, was more precious than their life. One thing about those men that went to prison, many of them received 15 to 20 year prison sentences, but when the leader of Russia at that time, and I believe that was Stalin, when he died, most of those people were pardoned and came back home. Most of the men only stayed in Siberia for 7 to 8 years and came back home. And I think it was about that time that the men were able to get jobs again. But that colony, the group of people that is now in BC, Canada, that group in Russia existed like that for 4 years. No jobs, just what they could scavenge and share and help each other. But they made it. At the end of that time, the KGB came to them and said, "We cannot break you." There was one of the officers that admitted that. He says, "We cannot break you." And they gave up. Certainly, they were tested and tested much. Then Russia opened up and they could leave. So that's not the end of their story. They had the opportunity to go back to Germany. I didn't realize this till I heard this from them, that Germany has a policy that anyone that was displaced, like during World War I or II, if they want to come back to what is called the fatherland, the government in Germany will aid you greatly. And when this large group of people sought to come to Germany, the German government said, "Sure, come right on ahead. We'll give you lots." I think they gave them the whole back end of a subdivision, and they built houses. And those men, because they had lived in colony, they can start from nothing. It seems like in short order, they've got material things because they know how to budget. And they'll live on nothing so that they can accumulate something. They bought a bus. Most of the men in that group worked at a factory together. They bought a bus, and about 40 of them would go to work every day on that bus. You know, instead of 40 people driving 40 cars. And they thought they had reached the promised land. The government gave them money. The government did all sorts of things for them in Germany. Things really went well for them. They became prosperous in just a very, very short time. And then the government said, "You have to put your children in our public school system." And they said, "Oh, no, no, no. That's why we came here, because that's what happened in Russia. We will teach our own children." And the German government said, "No, we gave you all this money and this land. You will send your children to our schools." German schools are very corrupt. Now, U.S. schools are corrupt, but I think Germany and France outrank us a little bit in corruptness. In Germany, they would have field trips that lasted a whole weekend, and even middle schoolers, it was co-ed, boys and girls staying together in a motel together. They said, "No, that can't be." And they immediately began to look to move again. They're ready to move. Again, I see people whose hearts and their mind is with their children, and they say, "We're willing to sacrifice again." And they move to Canada. And they, because of being used to living in colony, they continue to live in colony there. The place that we visited, where we had our teacher training, was called Peace Land Farm, I think. That was the original place. Some of the Eastern brethren there in BC helped them in doing some of the building and getting things started, helped them in many ways. But they said, "No, we want to be our own people. We are Russian Pentecostals," and that's the way they stayed. they have good friends amongst the Eastern churches there. But as time went on, that colony grew to 450 people. And at that point, they were bursting their seams. So they started another farm some distance away. There are now five different places, I think, where there are colonies there in the Fort St. John area, constantly growing. Those people know how to work together for their schools, and schools are important to them. When CLE goes and does a teacher training that's off from our training center there in the valley, we ask that, I mean, if a church would call us up and say, will you come and have a teacher training, let's say in Indiana, one of the first things I tell them is we like to have 10 people participate so that the cost is defrayed somewhat by that. When we went to BC, there was 42 teachers. Not all of them teachers. Some of them hoping to be teachers at some point. Some of them were school board members. Some of them were just concerned people that wanted to take the course. Now, those 42 people weren't all from just the Fort St. John area. Most of them were from the different farms there. There was a group, though, of about 18, I think, that had left the colony and had started another group up in Alaska. They drove 22 hours to come. Stayed the week, of course, but they had originally been part of the colony and were welcomed back. It was great to see the fellowship there between people that were apart for a while. 22 hours they drove just to come to that teacher training. And Pete and I were humbled by such dedication to the teaching of students. We had a very good class. They were eager to learn. See, they're struggling with English as their second language or third or fourth language too. And there's a lot of hurdles to be crossed there. But they are so interested in teaching their own children, having their own school, having the opportunity to maintain not only their culture, but their love for Jesus Christ and the desire that the next generation will also know and that the next generation will be able to teach the following generation. And we ask Fred and Rudy at some point, Pete and I did, we said, how are you going to maintain this? These stories are wonderful. We had a great time listening to these stories. How are you going to maintain this, though, once you're gone? Well, they said, we worry about that. They said, every October we get together for a kind of a Thanksgiving day. And all the colonies there at Fort St. John get together and they tell stories. The older people tell stories of the past. They're trying to keep it alive that way. How do we keep that alive in our circles? Do our children know that we would sacrifice anything to maintain our Christian school that's been around for a long time? Or do they think, well, is it really important? How important is education to us? Do we just see value in it as a way to gain knowledge? Or is it a way to pass on our faith to a future generation? Is it a way to maintain our culture in a very sinful, ungodly world in which we live? And that's one thing that concerns me as I work with these groups, is they have come over here, and just like I mentioned at the beginning of how some of the Slavic Ukraine older people say, well, we grew up in communist Russia, and those people actually went to the public school there. And we survived with our faith. Why, we're in Christian public schools over here in the U.S. What's the deal? Do we realize that our Christian schools are so integral in promoting our way of life, and, you know, let alone the most important thing of bringing our children into the fold of Jesus Christ? What would you be willing to sacrifice so that your child or your school's children could be educated with godly values. May the Lord bless.
Two scriptures come to my mind as I listen this evening. The latter story here, I'm reminded of, as the KGB said, we will break you. I'm reminded of the story of Job when I don't know that Job ever knew what we know. I don't know that he ever knew what was happening behind the scenes or not. But we know how the Lord asked Satan, have you considered my servant Job? And Satan said, yes, but if you, then he will break. And it makes me wonder what Satan is saying to the Lord about our own people today. When God says, have you considered these people, us? And Satan said, yes, but if you, I don't know what he said, but we know he's always at work. What is it that will break us or is trying to break us? I'll let you ponder that. The second scripture that came to my mind with the first story is the where we have people saying, can you come and help us teach or help us see how to do our schools? I think of the scripture in Luke 9, but when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion at them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Then saith he unto his disciples, the harvest truly is plenteous, but the laborers are few. Pray ye therefore the Lord of the harvest that he will send forth laborers into the harvest. I often marvel at that passage, wondering, does Jesus need our prayers to send forth laborers if he sees that laborers are needed? And if he, the Lord, is going to send them forth, does he need our prayers to send them forth? Well, we can ask analytical questions like that, but we're left with the scripture. And it says, regardless of what we think, it says, pray therefore. And so today one of the things we've talked about is how sometimes we struggle to find teachers for our schools. The fact is, there are other people saying, can you help us? There's even a Macedonian call. Can you help us? The harvest truly is great in many ways. A few logistics before we dismiss. The CD orders, there's a place in the basement to order them. And does Mark or somebody know when, do they pick them up here or do they all get mailed? Does anybody know that here? Any of the local people? All right, we'll get back to you that in the morning. But anyway, those orders are there in the basement and there's a box there to put contributions in for the CDs. Evaluation forms. We take these seriously. This is actually what we use to decide what you are telling the committee are your needs. There's nothing quite so frustrating as to be scratched where you're not itching. And so you need to tell us where those itches are so that in another year the topics that are addressed, things that are addressed are, in fact, what you are wrestling with and pondering about. So we take this seriously. This is not just a formality. So please take time to prayerfully consider and topics, also names of people, how to contact those people, and in addition to that, invitation. Now, we probably will not meet in this part of the country, that is in Pennsylvania, next year. I don't know where that will be, but we do look for invitations to host the event. There is a box for the evaluation forms if you're before you leave. Why, you can leave it there in the box. It's on the back table on this floor now, back there on the table with the free things right against the wall. And if you'll be here, just leave it here. And although it is also, if you want to give more thought to that and be more complete in your form, you're welcome to take it along. Statistically, If you take it along and don't fill it out before you leave, the statistics are not very great on people sending them in afterwards. So, but I'll leave that with you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.